So I told you last time that the I need my big chalk. I told you last time that the smoking gun for a human impact of climate has been the of human impacts on climate, but CO2 is the big one. So that's the real temperatures. So here's sort of 1970, and here's now. So from thermometers, and they can get that if they tell the models about the greenhouse gases, but with natural only forcing, they can't. So, you know, that's pretty simple, but what should probably be sort of nagging at you now, here I am telling you that I think we need to change, you know, how we do energy, and you read Friedman, and it sounds like it's a whole new world. He calls it the energy climate era, a big deal. And you may be wondering to yourself, well, but this blip since the 70s, is that really a big deal? Or, you know, I mean, weather is chaotic. Can it just kind of do that kind of on its own? I mean, is this such a big deal? And the way to address that is to put this warming since the 70s into a much larger context of how the climate of the Earth has been documented to change through time, looking back into the deeper past. And the name for that endeavor is paleoclimatology. The study of past climates. So we have temperature thermometer records that go back to the invention of the thermometer by Fahrenheit in 1860 or something like that. But to go back further than that, you got to be a little bit clever about how to figure out what climate has done in the distant past. Since there were no thermometers before then, we have to rely on what they call proxy data. So this could be proxy temperatures or rainfall or CO2 levels or whatever. Clever ways of finding how information gets stored in natural, you know, lake sediments or ocean sediments or ice cores or tree rings or something like that, and figuring out how to figure out what the climate has been doing in the past before the sort of thermometer sort of era. So some of you may have taken a class called Ice Age Earth, which is sort of one of the companion classes to this one, in which case you've had a whole semester of, a whole quarter of paleoclimatology. But we're just going to sort of go over it a little bit in one day and talk about how it, you know, speaks to the global warming forecast kind of in particular. So these proxy temperature or proxy paleoclimate data, the overall impression I have is sort of wonderment at kind of the creativity of the scientific enterprise. They come up with amazing. Boy, you measure this trace element, and then you correlate it with this, and it turns out that it, you know, tells you that. It sort of illustrates the kind of free market innovative quality of the scientific enterprise, because everybody's, you know, desperate to like get tenure or get their grants funded or get their papers published or whatever. And we're all kind of competing with each other. So, you know, ideas that don't work get sort of slowly stomped into the ground, and ideas that do work, other people jump on board, and then they sort of grow and develop. And there's no way that you could make this all happen from sort of a top-down command and control kind of thing. It really requires, it's a lot like Friedman talking about energy infrastructure, that you can't do that by top-down control either. You just sort of set the environment and then let individual competition and sort of the free market for ideas, dog-eat-dog sort of world, spur the creativity. And that's sort of how I think about this proxy data. So one form of proxy data that we'll see in a second comes from tree rings. So trees, this only works for trees in the temperate latitudes where there's sort of a summer and a winter. Doesn't work in the tropics because there's, you know, it's warm all the time there. There's not seasons in the same way. But in trees like around here, they grow in the summer and then they kind of don't grow so much in the winter. And so you get these rings and, you know, you can count the rings back. You go to some state park and you can count the rings back to when Abe Lincoln was a boy and all that sort of stuff. So those are... They are very easy to sort of line them up with years. And you can even take older pieces of wood. So say you have one piece of wood and it's got this pattern of tree rings thicknesses. I'm sort of exaggerating, but some of them are, the rings are wider and some of the rings are less wide. And we're saying that tells us something about temperature. So say you have some tree that goes to today and goes back in time, and then you have some other tree that, you know, some piece of wood that you get from somewhere, and it's got this pattern that starts there, and then it sort of goes back, and you can match it up and take a whole bunch of these trees and put them together to make records that are longer than the lifetime of any individual tree. But there are things that affect tree rings besides just temperature, so it's a tricky world. The width is affected by temperature, but also by rainfall, maybe CO2 concentration, competition with other trees. Age of the tree, all kinds of things like that. So getting a record that just tells you the temperature out of tree rings requires a lot of sort of statistical, you have to take the whole, what they do is they take all of the temperature reconstructions for individual sites, which, you know, may be affected by temperature but may also be affected by these other factors, and then try to put them into a coherent picture for the whole world. And the idea is that there are patterns of climate variability for the planet, like El Nino has a particular pattern. If it's cold here during El Nino, it's going to be warm over there. So they look for those kind of patterns in this map of all this tree ring data. And to the extent that it matches those patterns, they say that's probably temperature. And then to the extent that some individual record, you know, doesn't fit any of those patterns, they say, well, maybe that's something else, and they sort of throw it out. And so, you know, it's not as good as having a real thermometer there. No question about it. It'd be better if thermometers had been invented by the ancient Greeks and, you know, had been, the temperature measurements had been made since then, but we got to work with what we got. And so this is one of the ways. One of the problems with tree rings is that still sort of unresolved is that the correlation with temperatures, they do a real great job of reproducing the temperature records up to about 1980. But then in that last little bit, the smoking gun time, there is warming that we know from the thermometers, and the tree rings don't seem to be getting that. So there are papers published on that. I think, you know, in my ignorance, I'm an oceanographer, what do I know about trees? Seems to me that probably CO2 is a likely explanation for what's doing this. But at any rate, the tree rings, mostly tree rings, go into making this temperature reconstruction here, known as the hockey stick. So the years, so here's the present, the year 2000, and it goes back about 1300 years, and there's this blue line here is one of the original ones, one of the original reconstructions done by a guy named Mike Mann. And then subsequent reconstructions have kind of more of a sort of natural variation in Earth's climate going through time. So right sort of in this region from sort of 1300 to 1700 or so is a time called the Little Ice Age. So this was a time when the Vikings sailed the oceans blue all over the world. No, sorry. Vikings sailed during this time, the medieval warm time, from like 800 to 1100 or 1200 or something like that. That was a time when, at least in Europe, it was sort of a warmer climate than before and afterward. Followed by this time, the Little Ice Age, which was kind of a crummy time to be in Europe. There were, I don't know, the climate was kind of, I mean, it was cooler by maybe a degree or something, but the main thing that you'd notice sort of on the ground from the Little Ice Age climate was it was just kind of a crappier climate. There were decades of drought followed by decades of extreme rain and decades of kind of sort of very cold conditions, and then, you know, some time when it was sort of dry again. There's a lot known about how society kind of fared during those centuries, and it was a noticeable thing. There was a story on the front page of the New York Times yesterday or Saturday, I think it was, about that some of you may have seen, about some hackers that had broken into a computer in England and stolen about 60 megabytes of email data. And one of the things that they that sort of rang some alarm bells was a phrase, "We're going to use Mike Mann's trick to hide the tree ring data." And that actually has to do with this plot here that we're looking at. So the problem is that these reconstructions from tree rings don't get that last little blip. And it's still a mystery kind of why that is. And so the trick, that was the unfortunate choice of word used, was to plot this solid black line, which is the instrumental records, the temperature records here, on top of it to sort of indicate, you know, where we know reality went, instead of just leaving it at the tree ring record and cutting it off at 1980 or something like that. So the wording from this email made it seem like they're trying to hide something, but, you know, it's just this, putting both of those things on the plot at the same time. So it's, you know, an interesting case study of how politics kind of moves forward. A colleague of mine spent his whole weekend working on this blog site answering accusations from readers about, well, how can you explain this in this email, and da-da-da-da-da. It's really kind of interesting to watch. There are other forms of proxy climate records. Tree rings are good for the last 1,000 years, although they do have that problem of the most recent times. There's also data from ice cores. So ice cores have little bubbles of ancient air, which is just, you know, a godsend to the climate community because, you know, it gives you some idea what the CO2 concentrations and methane and other gases were going back through time. These now go back something like 800,000 years. There are also Other things stored in ice cores that can give you ideas about past climates, there's dust. There's actually products from cosmic rays that tell you something about the intensity of the sun. So cosmic rays come from out, you know, from supernovas or something like that out in the galaxy. They come from all directions. It's not just from our galaxy, but it's from all over the place. And they're very, very high energy. And they come into the atmosphere and they do nuclear reactions to the gases there. So this is where carbon-14 comes from. If you do C14 dating of some archaeological site or something, that C14 comes from this nuclear chemistry up in the upper atmosphere from cosmic rays. So when the sun is particularly intense, it shields the Earth from cosmic rays, and so you get less of these C14, beryllium-10, these radioactive isotopes, these radioactive atoms that get made in cosmic rays, you get less of them when the sun is strong, because the sun, the magnetic field of the sun shields the Earth. So, you know, this is an example of cleverness. Who would have thought of this story, that you go to Antarctica and measure, you know, these trace radioactive things to tell you how bright the sun was in the past? But from times when we know how bright the sun was going back in time, from sunspot numbers that go back to 1650 or something like that, when Galileo invented the telescope, these isotopes, you know, tell the same story as the sunspot numbers. And so then, you know, we trust it enough that we use it to go back further in time. That's pretty ingenious, I think. There are also indications you can get about past climates from isotopes. So the most prominent example is isotopes of oxygen. So there's oxygen 16 and oxygen 18. So they're both oxygen. They both have the same number of electrons, and so they have the same chemistry. You know, they both bind with hydrogens to make water and all of that. But the oxygen 18 has two more neutrons in the nucleus, and so it's heavier. Same chemistry pretty much, but it's got slightly different properties than the more common one, which is oxygen 16. So the whole planet kind of acts like a still. So if this is the planet, and here's the equator, and it's warm down here, and there's lots of evaporation, you get this water that has oxygen 18 and oxygen 16 in it. And the oxygen 18, because it's heavier, sort of preferentially rains back out. Just a little bit. Not a lot, not a huge difference, but just a little bit. And so the whole planet is like a giant still that distills out the lighter of the two isotopes, because the heavy one keeps dropping out and dropping out. And so by the time you get up to an ice sheet, this is sort of more dominated by oxygen 16. Than the ocean average is, because of this giant still. So they talk about using. Well, never mind. I'm gonna go there. You have this huge ice sheet that has lots of oxygen 16 in it, and so the ocean gets sort of richer in oxygen 18, because the ice sheets are made of this oxygen 16. So the oxygen isotopes recorded in calcium carbonate. So the oxygen 18 gets turned into calcium carbonate that has more than its share of oxygen 18 in it. And this calcium carbonate gets buried in sediments. So the way they know about how the ice sheets have been growing and shrinking through time is by clever means like this, measuring the amount of oxygen 18 and oxygen 16 in sediments. So again, you know, it's not as good as having satellite pictures from 20,000 years ago, but you know, we don't have that, so they do what they can to sort of figure out how past climates worked. So going back to this hockey stick, we've got all these various studies that are sort of in competition with each other to figure out, you know, to publish the best climate records going back. And the more recent ones, like this purple one here, do have more, in the statistical way that they treat the data, they do have more sort of long-term climate variability. The medieval warm time, you know, around 1000 AD, and then the Little Ice Age, more so than the original hockey stick. But the temperatures today, you can see, are kind of higher than they have been in that entire, you know, 1300 year time frame. So let's sort of track lessons from the last 1,000 years, and this has been called the hockey stick. Because of its general, you know, its initial shape in the Mann curve of, you know, flat and then shooting up at the end. They call that the hockey stick. And the rest of them are sort of kind of like fairly warped hockey sticks, but the name kind of sticks, kind of lingers on. So what we can learn from it is that the Earth is warmer today than it has been in 1300 years, which is going back as far as the tree rings, you know, kind of can take us. Second, we can learn that there are natural climate changes. Driven by the sun, the intensity of the sun. So the telescope was invented right around 1600, 16 something-ish, right in here. And pretty much right away, people figured out, Galileo figured out how to put a you know, probably a filter on there so he wouldn't burn his eye out, but then can look at the sun, and he saw these sunspots, and people started making records of sunspots. The Little Ice Age correlates with a time of no sunspots. Called the Maunder Minimum. So it lasted for about 40 years or something like that. So today there's always some sunspots, usually some sunspots on the sun, and the number that you see if you look kind of goes up and down with this sort of 11-year cycle, the sunspot cycle. Thank you. So today there's a sort of sunspot cycle. There hasn't been any trend overall since the 70s, but there is this sort of 11-year cycle. The thing comes and goes, and it makes a little bit of difference. But there was a time in the past, this Maunder minimum, when there were no sunspots. And that's thought to mean that the sun was a little bit cooler then, and that explains the coolness of the Little Ice Age sort of throughout these centuries in here. And then we don't have sunspot counts going further back than that, but we have these cosmogenic isotopes, the cosmic rays that make the beryllium-10 and the carbon-14 that tell us that the sunspots were back in action before that during the medieval warm time. So the sort of drift of the climate up and down throughout those thousand-year time seems like it fits pretty well with the intensity of the sun. So the sun can drive climate to change. So, and then another point of comparison here is that we can kind of look at these temperature changes and sort of compare them with what's happened so far and what's projected for the future. So the medieval sort of warm time was about maybe 0.5 degrees C warmer than sort of a long-term average. The Little Ice Age may be 1 degree C cooler sort of than a long-term average. So we're talking about changes that are sort of a degree or a fraction of a degree centigrade. The warming so far is about 0.7 degrees C, and the forecast for 2100 under business as usual is about 3 degrees C. Something like, I don't know, there's a range, 2 to 6 degrees was sort of the upper end of the range according to, you know, with all the uncertainties and everything. So Mark Linus called his book 6 degrees instead of 5 degrees or whatever, because that's kind of the worst possible case. So these climate changes in the last 1,000 years driven by changes in the intensity of the sun are sort of comparable to the warming that we've seen so far. And they were not the end of the world, nor is climate change so far the end of the world. We don't have, you know, millions of climate refugees or, I mean, the warming that has been seen so far is kind of like the fire alarm. It's not like the fire exactly. The forecast for the end of the century is a different beast entirely from what we've seen so far or what has been happening in the last sort of 1,000 years. The medieval warm time it wasn't a uniform warming. So the funny thing about the climate today is that almost every place is warming. There are a few exceptions. The interior of Antarctica is not warming, and but most every place else has been getting warmer over the last couple of decades, and the oceans have been getting warmer. You can imagine some, you know, rearrangement of heat, you know, because of differences in ocean circulation, El Nino, that sort of thing, that, you know, so the air might get warmer and then the ocean might get cooler if you change the way that the heat is sort of cycling around. The climate change, natural climate changes have been sort of heterogeneous, like higher there and cooler there, whereas the warming just since the 70s, our smoking gun warming, has been every place warming at the same time. So what that means is that it's not just redistributing heat, but you've actually got a monkey somehow with the heat budget of the planet. You can't just sort of warm everything up just by, you know, saying, well, weather is chaotic. You have to have energy to do that. So the trapping of the energy by infrared is the explanation, although one could imagine doing the same thing by changing the cloud droplets or something like that. Medieval time was a good time to be in Europe. Harvests were big and civilization grew and flourished and you know, there was all this extra energy that people had to build these cathedrals and all that stuff in gratitude, you know, to a benevolent world. So you can read the argument that because the medieval warm time was good time in Europe, that warming is good. The trouble there is that the medieval warm time is nothing like the forecast for the coming century. So it's like saying that, you know, if potato chips are good, it's good to have 10 tons of potato chips dropped on your head or something. You got to beware of the sort of bait and switch. Going back deeper into time, we have the glacial interglacial cycles. So the CO2 concentration in the air comes from bubbles in the ice cores, and here's methane in the air. So both of them go up during the warm times. The interglacial times are these times that have the gray sort of band there. So we're in interglacial time now, and CO2 was 280 parts per million before people started cutting down trees and everything like that. Methane also goes up and down because in a warmer world, there's more swamps. It's a wetter world. And so swamps are like the main source, natural source for methane. And then here is the oxygen 18 from calcium carbonate at the bottom of the ocean that we just talked about. And it tells you basically how big the ice sheets were. And so if the number is down here, that means the ice sheets are big. And when the number is up there, that means the ice sheets are smaller. So we have this sort of detailed time record of the glacial interglacial cycles and how the greenhouse gases and the ice volume of the Earth sort of work together. So the way that the ice ages work, the glacial cycles, is that there are variations in the Earth's orbit around the sun. And as the orbit sort of changes through time, it doesn't change the total amount of sunlight that the Earth gets by very much, just very, very tiny changes. But it has a large change in what latitude and what season the sunlight comes in. So we talked about this before. There's sort of a sweet spot of global climate that the sunlight intensity at 65 degrees north in the summer determines what happens to the ice sheets. So this is called Milankovitch theory, and it goes back, you know, many decades. They know how the Earth's orbit wobbles as a function of time. You can calculate that. Actually, if it was just the Earth and the Sun, there probably wouldn't be these wobbles. It's a three-body problem. So you put together Earth, the Sun, and Jupiter, and then now you get this kind of weird kind of sort of wobbling in the Earth's orbit. And they can calculate that. And the timing of it correlates really well with the way the ice sheets are going here. But there is also this kind of feedback with CO2. So the orbit drives the ice sheets, but then somehow when the ice sheets say, let it be cold, the CO2 goes down. So here's a time, last glacial maximum, when the ice sheets are big and the CO2 is lower. And then the ice sheets sort of collapse over a time of about 10,000 years, and then the CO2 rises. So somehow the carbon cycle is kind of is providing a positive feedback here. So one sort of false conclusion which can be drawn and which you can probably read if you look for it in our world full of disinformation as it seems to be is that the glacial cycles show that temperature controls CO2. So I guess the sort of not always clearly spoken conclusion from this is that therefore CO2 can't drive temperature. So for example, at the end of the last ice age, so now time, we're going to say going this way, and the ice, let's see, the temperature in Antarctica went up, and the CO2 concentration started going up. And the CO2 started going up after the temperature started going up by a couple hundred years. The resolution of these bubbles in ice is not as good as tree rings or something like that. So it's dicey to figure out exactly how much time elapsed between when the temperature in Antarctica started going up and the CO2 started going up. But people can gleefully claim at this point, well, obviously CO2 isn't driving temperature because the temperature started going up first. That's a false conclusion because by the time the temperature went all the way up, that took 10,000 years, and the CO2 had changed quite a bit in that amount of time. So it doesn't say that the temperature warmed all the way without any help from CO2. And it kind of, to say that cause and effect goes one way, meaning therefore that it can't go the other, that's spurious because we know about feedbacks. Feedbacks are a loop of cause and effect. It can go both ways. That's what you need to make a feedback, is you need the loop. In general, so true conclusions from the glacial cycles are, it turns out that CO2 drives about half of the temperature change. The rest is from the ice albedo. So you can use the reconstructed climate of the glacial world as a test for the climate models. You can sort of tune your chops to make sure you're not clueless by reproducing these huge climate changes in the past. And they find that the models do a perfectly fine job of simulating the glacial climate. There's something called the climate sensitivity. Which is the change in temperature that you would get from doubling CO2. and the climate sensitivity that they figure out that they, you know, that they need to explain the glacial interglacial cycles is the same climate sensitivity as they get from the climate models sort of looking forward. So you can sort of use these past climate changes as a test for the climate models. And they make the models much more robust. They're more reliable if you can reproduce things that happened in the past. So in general, there's no indication from these past climate changes that there's any that the Earth is like not sensitive to CO2 or something like that. Let me just show you one last thing from the from paleoclimatology. These are called abrupt climate changes. So this is a time scale during the glacial time, so between 60,000 years ago and 30,000 years ago. It wasn't the coldest of the cold time, but it was during a time when the Earth was approaching the glacial, the coldest, the maximum ice sheet. And there are all these indications of very, very fast changes in climate. Just a few years, the climate sort of does this flip-flop trick in the it seems to be centered around the North Atlantic. So these abrupt climate changes it seems like they go between an Atlantic Ocean. They have ingredients. They're not completely well understood, but they have ingredients of the circulation of the ocean in the Atlantic and sea ice. And there also seems to be a component of instability of the ice sheet. The Laurentide ice sheet, which was, you know, right here. It was in North America. So it's not really well understood exactly how this worked, but somehow the whole system did this like flip-flop thing, back and forth, very, very regularly. Every 1,500 years or something like that, there would be this very, very severe cooling in Greenland where the ice core is recording temperatures, and then global sort of changes around the world. Models of the climate can kind of reproduce this a little bit, but they sort of underestimate the severity and the global extent of these abrupt climate changes. So they give us credibility in the models, but they say that, if anything, there may be sort of extra tippiness in the real world that we're not really quite completely able to capture in climate models. So it's a kind of a sobering warning that uncertainty is not really a good thing in this, because if anything, it's likely to be worse rather than better. That's what the paleoclimate data is telling us. Okay, so I'll see you on Wednesday.